You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. First of all, I want to thank those who have given to me. As I said the last time, it's absolutely necessary, and any of you, my donors will be receiving it's essentially a rough draft, but it's very readable, rough draft of my book of essays on the Soviet Union. Which I think is some of my best work, things that absolutely no one else is saying. But no doubt, within a year, the likely set of suspects will be repeating its views as if it's their own. And there'll be people stealing from it from all over the place. And I should take that as a compliment, but it's very irritating. And the only reason I don't get more upset about it is that really with one notable exception, and you know who I'm talking about, no one makes any money off of it. It's simply a matter of propagating the ideas. My stuff is very original, and it's very original because I have this confluence of variables equally fluent in both Western and Eastern ideology and philosophy at a very deep level, not just a sloganeering level. My doctoral degree is in the history of political philosophy, which meant that I was in three departments, history, philosophy, and political science. And that, although very difficult, and my committee was oversized for that reason, I had to master the methods of three separate fields. And you don't see this very often. You don't see this combination very often. So what happens is that I have developed a very unique, approach to things. And this is really the reason. And that many of you have made it possible for me to do this full time. I have to do it full time because I don't know how to do anything else. I am a historian and I make very, very cute babies. That's it. Otherwise, I'm a waste of time. I as many of you know, I am really almost obsessed with exposing pseudo-intellectuals. Pseudo-intellectuals are these faux intellectuals, or people who are looking at the work that it takes to become a legitimate expert in a certain intellectual field and are very intimidated by it. They see walls and walls and walls of books and papers and lectures and study and note taking for years and years and years and years and years, and they don't want to do it. Rather, they figure that if they memorize enough slogans and dress a certain way and speak a certain way, they can fool people who don't know much. Johnson's Law is something that I discovered when I was studying Burma. I mentioned this before, but Johnson's Law also applies to these kind of people. The average American, the average educated American, is a half-wit. This is an unfortunate reality that makes our lives, my life especially, very, very difficult. Part of being a half-wit is that you think you're well-informed. You don't realize that the press, and in terms of, you know, politics and history, this is entertainment. This isn't scholarship. In the United States, everything has to be commodified. To be commodified, it has to be essentially commodification is the preparation of something for sale. It's packaging. And when that's applied, of course, intellectual topics, it's utter disaster. Now, I've been asked to do this more than once, and I've resisted it. But briefly, I want to talk about how to spot one of these people. Johnson's Law states that the more obscure the area or the topic, the more a journalist or a writer or a commentator or a politician will both have the incentive to make stuff up about it and lie about it, as well as make honest mistakes about it, because they just don't know. And there are so few people who can correct them that really, who cares? They know that they can get away with it. Therefore, they don't really have to work very hard in putting their argument together. Why struggle and go through all this, all these papers and all this material if people aren't going to correct you anyway? But that also goes for just the average person out there, the average educated person out there, who then says, because it's obscure, because at a cocktail party or a job interview, no one's going to correct me, so why am I going to suffer? Why am I going to go through all this material and work all this hard when I could just drop a name and drop a slogan and sound, especially if you have a British accent, forget about it. You know, everything you say sounds brilliant, no matter how stupid it might be. And it's become the my pet peeve, the bane of my existence. Well, women is really the bane of my existence. But apart from that, this kind of pseudo-intellectual and the real threat that they pose is that they sound like they have authority, especially for younger people who are impressionable and want to learn about something. They can completely poison them and destroy them, and it takes a long time to deprogram them afterwards. There's a few ways over the years that I've learned how to spot them, and I want to warn you right away that exposing them in public, as I've done many times, can be extremely dangerous. You know, when it's embarrassing, you know, what can happen later on, and as they stew in their anger over time, be extremely careful in the context in which you do this. But they need to be exposed because they hurt a lot of people. I think overall, for historical topics, that's what this show is about, so that's what we're going to talk about. The main giveaway is when they use modern terminology, modern Western terminology that we use to discuss our modern life, and then impose that on something, say, an ancient society or a medieval society or a foreign society, an Asian society, for example. Even worse is if they condemn the society for not recognizing our postmodern concepts. This is extremely important. It happens all the time. For example, they'll use the word like, you know, human rights to refer to Sparta. That human rights were not respected there. Now, that's an extreme version. I mean, but there are people that's stupid. And there are professors that I've had in my life who actually talk like that. Another way to spot them is the use of faux technical vocabulary. Instead of saying debate, they'll use the word discourse, for example. They use the word regime to talk about a government they don't like. Postmodern is another very common one. Existential. This is my favorite one, the existential threat. I don't know where this came from, but I'm familiar with the philosophy of existentialism, and they're not. This country poses an existential threat to something. And connected to that is the idea of using academic jargon to make a very simple point. And you see this everywhere. And I think some of you know what I'm talking about. The excessive use of academic jargon to make a point that is actually very, very easy to explain. Related to that is the overuse of foreign words. Amelia Durand, who's writing for Countercurrents. I have a lengthy critique of some of his works coming out. And something he does is, out of nowhere, he'll say a word like Orthodox, and then in parentheses, he'll give the Russian word for it. there's no call for that. Or he'll say the word commune and give the Russian word in parentheses. There's no reason to do that. The only reason someone would do that is to make themselves seem like they're an authority in the matter. And when you're talking with someone verbally, the overpronunciation of foreign words is something you really need to catch. So, you know, it's fake. I don't need to do that. I do it very little because my readers and my listeners are English speakers. When these people don't differ in any way from the mainstream press, when the range of opinions that they give could be found in the Washington Post, they don't know anything. Because it has to mean that they start with those opinions. Of course, all opinions aren't equal. They're extremely unequal. I've been at this now, this January. This is the first show of the new year, 2018. This marks my 28th year of, for better or for worse, doing this full time. I'm going to get a little snippy when some 18-year-old who read a pamphlet yesterday starts lecturing me about it. I don't have the patience that the ordinary person does. An opinion maybe can be very, very, very tentatively given after maybe 15 years of concentrated study. And even there, you know, you end up revising it over time. A lot of intellectual laziness. I mentioned this the last time. Saying that Russian economic growth is based on high oil prices. Well, everyone says that. Unfortunately, the economy is not based on oil. About 8%, between 8 and 20, who you read, between 8 and 10% of the GDP, not the GNP, but the GDP, is based on oil. Norway actually has a more oil-based economy. So that can't be the case. Now, it might be the case with Saudi Arabia because they don't do anything else. But in the Russian case or the Indonesian case, or even in the Venezuelan case, their economy is very diversified. And their economic fortunes don't go up and down. And you could show this by showing a low oil price, and yet that very same year they have high economic growth. That kind of laziness, that kind of or one of my favorites is they're not all like that. Well, anyone can say that. It's a stupid comment because it's obvious. Of course, I'm not making reference to every individual in the class. I'm making reference to the class. And when you start talking like this, they don't understand you because they don't understand the distinction between an abstraction and a universal. Those aren't the same. An abstraction has no content. The universal contains everything in that class in it. All men have two legs. That's true. It's not empirically true. That's not what I'm referring to. There's plenty of people who have had them blown off or shot off or are deformed and therefore don't have two legs. That's not what I said. I said all men have two legs. That is not the same thing as saying that every single member of that class has that property. The fact that they won't understand that is proof that they shouldn't be speaking really much at all and should be answering my phone rather than trying to lecture me on something. A lot of contextless statements. Someone says the country is so poor that they live on $2 a day. That fact tells me nothing because I don't know how much a dollar can stretch in this area. And one of my favorites, when they claim that a politician has control, the Reagan economy, the Kennedy economy, the Nixon economy, as if these people are in corporate boardrooms making investment decisions. A president can barely control his cabinet, let alone the economy of a country. The notion that they have to personalize everything. They can't think in universal terms, so they have to put a person on it. This is very primitive thinking. And of course, virtue signaling is, to me, essentially, this is an excuse for physical violence. When the only reason they're saying something is to show the world or show some power center, someone more powerful than themselves, that they are harmless, that they're on the same page, that they're on the same team. You see this in academia all the time. A new professor is hired. Let's say he's a white male, which is very rare. And then you'll see his office door covered with all kinds of anti-racist and anti-sexist sloganeering and cartoons and bumper stickers and everything else. If the guy was a plumber, he wouldn't be holding to that view. But because it's absolutely required for success in academia, that's now his opinion. And these people deserve the mockery that they often get. And non-whites are never impressed by this. They know his virtue. They know what virtue signaling is. It's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of a complete lack of a backbone, and no one really respects it. Needless to say, the use of cliches constantly is, you know, one of the more obvious. I mean, this is kind of contained in everything I'm saying. The use of cliches that you might hear on CNN or might read in the New York Times, as if they have created it, they've invented it themselves, as they're saying something very profound, making very obvious statements, as if they're revealing something to you, is something, again, you need to stop listening to this person. The improper use of jargon. Now, when I say jargon, I mean technical terms that are technical to a field that sound like something ordinary. Words like law or constitution are used in everyday speech, but they're also used in a specialized way by historians when they use phrases like a priori or dualism or relativistic. They're really the point could be made with more normal terms. They're trying to prove something that they're phony. There's a lot of common errors that you can tell they're just picking it up from a textbook. Off the top of my head, you see, Karl Marx was Hegel's student, which is impossible and never happened. And Karl Marx hated Hegel and rejected him in almost every way. French Revolution comes from Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Nothing could be further than the truth, from the truth. That capitalism is the same thing as a free market. That when you refer to the term private property, that refers to personal property rather than productive capital. These are really stupid errors that when they're committed, you know that nationalism is from the 19th century. These are stupid errors that any freshman in college will make. Anyway, I don't want to belabor this point, but that's a handful and really the most obnoxious set of ways that you could spot the phony. Someone who hasn't put the time in. Some of these are worse than others. But whenever you hear some of those, some very suspiciously textbook statements being made, as if this is something that they have just discovered yesterday and are deigning to inform you of it, you know to stop listening to them, and you have every right to tell them, I don't think you're actually an expert in this situation. I don't think you are. I think you're trying to pose as one, and please stop. Because younger people who don't really know and who are impressionable can be led by you. You sound like you have authority, but in fact you don't know anything. It's very, very rare for an academic in my field to go beyond the headlines in New York Times. And I can't count the number of times I've asked them, why did you bother to get a PhD if you were just going to spout the official line all the time? What is the point of your existence here? I was a grad student saying stuff like this. The only reason I got away with it is because I was friends with them first. They knew I was a nice guy. I was a harmless guy. And because of that, they tolerated it. You can't just walk in on the first day and start doing that. You need to make friends with them first, show them that you're a decent guy. And then you can pretty much say whatever you want, because then they know that you're not exactly a threat. You're just nutty. And that's a very nice place to be in, especially in this society. Anyway, I wanted to get that off my chest. It's extremely important today as standards, educational standards, and what's considered intelligent is getting worse and worse and worse as language is getting more and more debased and denuded of meaning. What I actually wanted to talk about is something I've been asked to do. And, you know, I'm hesitant to do it because it's too large of a topic. And that's Oswald Spengler. I dislike people like Oswald Spengler. I mean, I respect them. You have a lot of people who make these meta analyses of civilizations, like Eric Vogelin and Toynbee, and it's a dangerous game because they have to be insanely oversimplified. So when Spengler talks about Russia, for example, he makes one error after another. It's not his fault. He's talking about numerous nations and numerous civilizations in the same chapter. How can you not be insanely oversimplified? I really am very skeptical of these meta historians who deal with entire civilizations as if they can be summarized in a few words, which is what they all do. And when you take, you know, if you take even a family and reduce it to a couple of slogans, you're going to be wrong, or at least very, very oversimplified. Let alone an entire civilization. In other words, a group of nations sharing a certain common trait. A specialist in one of those nations will say this, it's just not true. And as much as I respect the effort, and that in many areas Spengler was absolutely correct, it's too simplified to work. One error that he makes, and I need to mention this, I'm writing on this at some length, is the notion of the Mongol influence on Russian racial background. I've talked about this before. There's no reason to believe that Mongols were Asian. They're not talking about people from Mongolia. Mongols have no records of ever occupying Russia. Genghis Khan was, at least at the time, depicted as white. Never Asian. Now, later depictions show him that way. But that's not really what I mean. The genetic work on Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, the work even from George Vinyansky, Marta Milinuk, Liarchuk, B.A. Maliarchuk, there's one after another of these genetic analyses that show precisely zero Asian roots in the Russian population. There's very few Asian words in the Russian language. In fact, Maliarchuk wrote, I believe it's 2002, I could be wrong on that, did a lengthy, it's actually a meta-analysis of different genetic markers for Great Russian. And the conclusion that he came to, and this has been redone and confirmed not only in Russian but also in English and German, is that the genetic type of the Russian population doesn't differ from that of Western Europe. Now we're speaking in very general terms. That Belarusians, Russians, and Ukrainians are of one type. Now this doesn't mean that it should all be one empire. I think that these should be independent states, all working together for a common goal, if that's how it's going to work, because occupation doesn't work. It hasn't worked in the past. Nevertheless, this has been done so many times that it has to be true. There is not a shred of Asian blood in the Russian population. Even if the Mongols were actually Asian, there's no reason to believe that that's true, but even if they were, there were too few of them administering the country, and they never occupied it in the sense that there was never a garrison in downtown Moscow. They ruled it indirectly. So even if it is true that they're Asian, there'd be no reason for any kind of mixture. There's far too many, psychological barriers for a group of people as distinct as Russians versus Central Asians. The great Saint Setapan of Novgorod, who was writing at the time of the Mongol invasions, never mentions that these people are Asians. He never even calls them Mongols. He calls them foreigners. He doesn't even say that they speak a different language. There's never any reference to having needing translators. They spoke Russian. And the biggest piece of evidence that I've come across is that the contemporary paintings of the battles between Russians and Mongols show both sides as absolutely identical in appearance. When they show Russians fighting, say, Turks, you can tell just by glancing at it that there's two different sides. That was not the case in any contemporary depictions of battles. And I needed to get that off my chest because it's an extremely common error. People who believe that Russians aren't Europeans, unfortunately, Hitler made that error. The British have always really promoted the notion that they're not really a part of Europe, only because the British Empire was quite threatened by them. From the Crimean War onward, although this goes way back before then, it reached a fever pitch at the Crimean War, that they are Mongols, and not Mongols meaning Asians, as opposed to just being a different ethnic group with different interests of the broader European population. Of course, they're extremely different in terms of culture and tradition from the rest of Europe because of their specific location, climate, and everything else. But of all the genetic work that's been done on Russia, I'll say it one more time, there is not a drop of Asian blood in them because there was never any reason for that. They were not occupied by an Asian power. They were not administered by an Asian power at any time in their history. And it's such a common thing. Now, no one in Russia believes this, that for some reason it has not leaked into American life yet. And I think I know why. Because it takes away a bit of propaganda that they are this nefarious, mysterious Asian people who only understand tyranny or, you know, some stuff. I mean, that was a British understanding of it. That was a German understanding of it. Whenever you're at war with someone, you want to make them seem sneaky and notorious and untrustworthy and things like that. And that's what happened. Really from Ivan IV onward. Whenever I deal with individual people on this show, I think it's very vulgar to try to summarize them in just an hour. I try to focus on a handful of their more significant contributions, rather than try to summarize an entire point of view, which, by the way, is precisely at odds with what people like, Spengler and Vogelin were trying to do. It's not to say that civilizations don't exist. They do. It's just that even a multi-volume work can only scratch the surface. It's really just, a way to probe the perimeters rather than to give any kind of detailed analysis. One very powerful contribution, something where Spengler was absolutely correct on, was the infamous distinction between culture and civilization. Most traditionalists, whether Eastern Europe or Western Europe, made this distinction, often not using the same vocabulary. Culture and civilization for Spengler, and you see this, you know, Danilevsky and Slavophiles, you see it all over the place, is one of quality. The culture is organic. It's natural. It's based on a family. It cannot be codified in words or legal systems. It's based almost on instinct as it is reason. It can be rationalized, but it's not rational. It's above reason. It's something that simply is. Like the family. You don't have to do some kind of a psychological analysis to prove that you need to love your family. You just do, and you always have. The same goes for cultures. Cultures are nations. And when I say nation, I'm referring to ethnic group. Now, Spengler uses the word state, and we've mentioned this before in the show. It's unfortunate because the German, which is the same as the English, doesn't mean what it means in our English distortion of the word. In English, when you say state, you're referring to the apparatus of government. In other words, you're referring to the armies and the police and the bureaucracy and the administration. That's not the German understanding. The German understanding of the word state is the constitution. And by constitution, I'm not referring to the piece of paper that the basic rules are written on. That's a manifestation of the constitution. It is not in and of itself the constitution. The constitution cannot be put into words. The constitution is every form of communication. It's the universe of meaning that all members of the community have in order for them to function at all socially. When you use language, you're assuming that your hearers know what you mean in depth. And not just that the words you're using are understood in the dictionary sense of the term, but also in the common denotative sense of the term, or I'm sorry, connotative sense of the term. So it's a heck of a lot more than just dictionary definitions. And it's not just words, of course. It's gestures and tones of voice and everything else that when you get down to it is an immensely complex understanding of communication. Even your posture, how you hold your head, everything else, the way you describe certain things, formal versus informal and all of this. This is all forms of language and therefore are all ethnic. Language, as I've said many times, is not just the words and the grammar. It's all forms of communication, which is another way of saying all forms of culture. It's national. It has to be. That's what nations are. This is what Spengler means by state and culture. It's one and the same thing. Civilization is the decay of culture. You see this in numerous traditionalist points of view without using that language. For us, often, civilization is not a bad term. It is for them. It is for him. Civilization is what happens when a culture begins to decay. It begins to focus on the written word. Law isn't just written on the constitution of a people. It's something that is written down that you have to follow or you go to jail. The minute governments have to rely on coercion, they've already collapsed. The minute anyone has to rely on coercion to get people to do what they need, has already lost. Edmund Burke says this. They've already collapsed. They've already lost legitimacy. Law is very rarely something you can write down. It only has to be written down when it gets, for whatever reason, violated on a regular basis. Civilization is mechanical. It's inorganic. It's a system that's clinging to power and has to codify everything in order to force adherence to its norms. It's a bad thing. Donilevsky, of course, the great Russian meta-historian, has the exact same thing, using different words. But there's the organic culture that as it decays, and how does it decay? It decays by becoming wealthy. The wealthier it gets, the more that the wealthy people have to protect themselves. It decays if it's taken too many traumas and doesn't have the resources to rebuild. Like the human body, for example. One disease after another, the immune system is compromised, it can't last much longer. This sort of thing. Prosperity, in the sense of increasing wealth, is just as bad as poverty. The minute you have a class that lives off money it doesn't earn, the minute you have a class that's based on parasitism, everything changes. Because when this class develops, they know that they don't deserve the money they have. They don't deserve the power that they have. They haven't contributed such that that kind of income and the power that's connected to it would justify. Because now we live in an extreme situation. We, you know, the modern America, 2018 America, has not a single positive element of it. Every aspect of it is an advanced state of decay. I struggle to find something good. It is indescribably evil. There is no theory, I guess, except nihilism. There is no theory. There is no social idea that can justify this system. And one of many obnoxious elements of it is the fact that you have people who are so wealthy And, I mean, there's numerous problems there. That wealth automatically means immense power, that there's a clear one-to-one correlation there, and that this wealth could never be earned. When someone is worth $1 billion, there is nothing you can do to contribute that much that you have earned this money. Maybe if the guy who cures cancer by himself in his basement, maybe he deserves that. And even there, otherwise, it's based on the extraction of rents. For Spengler, for Dentalist, for so many of these people, myself included, the very existence of a rent is a sign of decay and illegitimacy. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this before. It's an extremely important concept that very few people understand. A rent, with a capital R, is a technical term. It refers to money extracted due to a non-economic end. If you had a situation of free exchange, that money could never be extracted. It's money extracted over and above economic exchange because the person you're contracting with has a lot more power than you. I often use the example of the defense attorney. Another word for rent would be premium. You're accused of a violent crime. You're looking at a lifetime in jail. You run to a good defense attorney. You mortgage your house. You will pay anything and do anything to hire someone who will get you off and get you considered innocent of this crime. Now, what you pay the defense attorney is not just based on what it costs to function as your defense attorney. The rent charged is based on your fear that the defense attorney will say, my God, this guy's petrified. He will do anything to get me to influence a jury that he's innocent or make him a deal or something like that. So I'm going to charge him double what I normally would because you know he's going to pay it. That's an example of a rent. A bribe is a classic example of a rent. Usury is an example of a rent. The word usury, in fact, doesn't just refer to interest rates. Usury is often a synonym for rent. But at the very least, usury is a subset of rent. Parasites are what we call rent seekers. They want to take money that has no real economic foundation, that the mere ownership of money earns you money. Which, of course, is a perversion because something that is not naturally fertile cannot reproduce itself. Rent seeking, or the ability to extract rent, to have it justified by the society and defended by the society, is one of the ways that you know that you have left the stage of culture and have now entered the stage of civilization and decay and death. Civilization is not a sign of decay. It is decay. By the time you reach that point, you have a state apparatus, not a state. You have an apparatus of coercion that needs to not just threaten everybody to get them to do what they want, but they need to manipulate them psychologically. We know that an authoritarian government that has no reason to exist can't function by having a machine gun nest in every roof. You can't do that. One way, speaking of which, one way you know you're dealing with a phony is when they're talking about a government they don't like, and they say that all dissent is criminalized. When I was in grad school, I had a professor say that a friend of his, a personal friend of his, had gone to prison in Iraq for saying that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. And I laughed at him. I said, excuse me, what government has the manpower and the resources to throw someone in jail for that? What do you mean, said he's a bad guy? What, was he at a bar or something? Was he at home? I don't care how tyrannical a government is. It can't criminalize stuff like that. It doesn't have the manpower or the money or the resources or the loyalty, even of its most fanatical enforcers, to do that. Because even fanatical supporters of a system are going to criticize it now and again. That can't be criminalized. However, the way that tyrannies operate isn't necessarily by having laws that have no legitimacy or the overuse of coercion. One way that my professor could have gotten out of it and didn't is to say that tyrannies operate by sporadic arbitrary arrests. This comes straight from Machiavelli. And it's keeping people constantly off balance. Keeping people off balance means that they never know if what they say or do is going to leave them in prison. That, you know, the very fact that it seems to be an arbitrary system rather than a system based on regular law. It would be one thing if an unjust law existed that was prosecuted legally on a regular basis. You might not like it. You just avoid that thing and you don't have anything to worry about. That's not how it works. Because governments don't have, illegitimate governments don't have the resources or the manpower ever to criminalize dissent. Because then even its most loyal followers will end up going to prison. It can't do that. It has to occasionally arrest dissenters or occasionally have a roundup of dissenters. You never quite know when you're going to be in trouble. That, psychologically, is far more effective than simply having this constant pressure on the population. But beyond that, that kind of coercion can't be sustained. It can be sustained in an emergency, and all societies have those periods of time. Everyone is on edge. There's something going on, the Civil War, whatever it is. That's okay. And no one denies that governments once in a while have to do this. It can't be done all the time. Liberalism, liberal capitalism has, and this is something that Spengler only slightly deals with. Given the time period he was writing, he couldn't possibly, this was only being seen for the first time. It is central to the thought of Alexander Dugin. In fact, if anything, his political theory can be reduced to this one concept. That liberal capitalism is a form of totalitarianism because, and it works nefariously because it doesn't use the state. It doesn't use the public sector. It doesn't use traditional forms of coercion. Liberal capitalism, especially in media and journalism, rules tyrannically because it alters the meaning of words, because it molds minds. It tells you what is good to want. It's able to tell you what's real and what isn't. Liberal capitalism is based as much on psychology as anything else. It completely blurs the distinction between needs and wants. It reduces people to consumers by telling them that there is no passion that should not be satisfied, no drive, no instinct, no desire that shouldn't be satisfied. And we can satisfy that for you for a fee. The government doesn't do that. Private sector entities do that. One sign of illegitimacy, as we said, you know, one sign of being ignorant. Someone who's, you know, a thaw intellectual, pseudo intellectual, is that they will believe or imply that only governments can be totalitarian or tyrannical. Governments make very bad tyrants. Up until the modern era, there was no such thing as a totalitarian system because no government had that kind of power. They didn't have a mass media. They didn't have mass journalism. And they didn't have the money. They didn't have the police apparatus would be so huge to do that. It's not possible. Authoritarianism meant control over the elites up until really the 20th century. All politics was local. And the central state simply couldn't penetrate to that level. It existed in the cities, but usually it meant that the elites were kept under constant surveillance. That, back then, was seen as authoritarianism. Only the 20th century developed the media and the psychological factors where everyone was kept under surveillance in the name of progress. Every development in technology has this shadow element. Liberal capitalism is totalitarianism because it's based on the satisfaction of passions and drives. Everything has a price. And you live in an environment where every passion should be indulged in one form or another. And you could be convinced by social sanction, keeping up with the Joneses, or advertising, everything else, or these concepts being, slowly sprinkled into day-to-day life, that you need something. To be considered successful, you have to have a house down the shore. You have to have a Lexus. You can't just get a Camry. It has to be a Lexus. You have to have a certain level of jewelry. You have to have certain kinds of clothes. And if you show up to a function without it, you are not in the club. And even more, that attractive women won't be interested in you. More than anything else, that passion controls men. I'm absolutely convinced. I know this for a thing. No one can change my mind. That men are essentially minimalists. The only reason they care about the homes and the cars and the clothes is that women are interested in that. And that's what will get you the attention of attractive females. That is the only reason why men care about that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's a lot of money and a lot of upkeep for flashing, just maybe, being flashy for the neighbors. That doesn't make much sense to me. Men indulge themselves in a huge amount of luxury goods because women demand it, either women that they want or women that they already have. 80% of discretionary spending in America is female. That's been documented over and over again, most recently by the Harvard Business Review. The economy is female because men don't really care that much. And I'm saying this because this is how a regime can get into every cell in the social body. It is so far superior than having a policeman in every corner, having, Secret Service sprinkled throughout the country. That's clumsy. Those guys can be bribed. No government has that kind of money. No government has a manpower for that. It's always very fragile. If you have a police apparatus that large, why wouldn't the heads of that apparatus take orders from the dictator? If the dictator is dependent on them, that means they can decide who the dictator is. It's ultimately a self-defeating. So, because it doesn't rely on the state, liberal capitalism is absolutely thoroughgoing totalitarian, because the desires that human beings have deal with every facet of life. The totalitarian system is based on the regulation of every aspect of life. Now, in the modern world, every aspect of life is amenable to political regulation, and therefore it's built into the system. But the way that postmodern liberal capitalism functions, our society functions, is that you make it profitable to regulate and control those aspects of life. That means handing it over to the private sector. It's the very core of oligarchy. Oligarchy is not just that a handful of very powerful, very wealthy people, run politics. No, it's also a state of mind that having certain things is the end of humanity. That being a success is identical with being wealthy. That someone who is wealthy by winning the lottery is as successful as someone who is wealthy by producing something that everyone wants or inventing something like that. For Spengler, I'm just focusing on this one element of his thought, what makes civilization a bad thing is civilization manifests decay, but it gets worse. And the way that you measure how bad it's getting is how much quantitative things, money especially, comes to define previously qualitative and rank-based goods. In modern America, if you use the word class, you automatically are, your mind has been hardwired into thinking of money. There's an upper class, a middle class, and a lower class. And those are defined by income or wealth that they have. But that's not the definition of class. That's never been only an oligarchy can convince people that that's the definition of class. No, class and rank are the same. Class traditionally, up until the 19th century, has been based on function, not on income. But when money has dissolved distinctions among things and becomes a good in and of itself, rank and function no longer have meaning. You have a lot of people, especially people who come from the middle classes or lower classes, who have a superstition that somehow the mere possession of money provides class, what they would call class, classy behavior, intelligence, refinement. My mother's like this. A lot of people are like this. They just, they're ignorant and they don't realize that it's something you have to work for. It's an aristocratic, not an oligarchic world. An aristocrat could be poor. An aristocrat is someone who has mastered his passions. And they've mastered their passions, mastered self-interest, I should say, to serve the common good. That's what an aristocrat is. But it is so easy for such people to become oligarchs where their world is based entirely on cash. The way it works in Spengler's mind is very common, is that intelligence, that is to say, the use of logic, becomes identical with knowledge. What I mean there, and I'm pretty sure what he means there, is that formal technique is identical with knowledge. And Michael Oakeshott says the same kind of thing. That to be knowledgeable is to know how to, you're trained in something rather than educated in something. Because possession of money and wealth is the be-all and end-all of humanity, population begins to decline. Because you are wealthier, the fewer children you have. The problem you have is that because income is so important, buying luxury items, or at least possessing luxury items, is so important that labor is worked more and more and more. When Western tastes began to take over Tsarist Russia, for example, you had a kind of a really vulgar, very fall Westernized elite forcing more and more out of their peasants to be able to afford luxuries imported from the West. It was a terrible crime against the population and separated the state from the common people. This is the Slavophile argument. Writers like Dostoevsky and Gogol used to make fun of the so-called aristocracy. Speaking French was considered refinement. So even your, you know, very low-level nobles pretended that, you know, they ended up being gibberish most of the time because they just didn't know. But trying to speak French was a way that you showed the world that you were cosmopolitan. More and more, the disconnect with the common people was manifest, and the legitimacy of the system, especially in the 18th century, began to decline. Urban civilization, I mean, you know, the decay of culture into civilization is very similar, but not identical to increased mass urbanization. The larger the city grows, the greater the demands for luxury items amongst the urban elites, the urban population in general, the pressures put on the countryside become unbearable. Now, the concept of sacrifice as a religious concept comes up again and again. Why was it that the Canaanite civilization, wherever it's gone, sacrificed children to Moloch? What was the point of this? How did it get that way? Well, it's not distinct from abortion. If you destroy a child in the womb because you know it wouldn't interfere with your career and money making, that is exactly the same thing as sacrificing a child for greater harvests or more financial success. It's the exact same thing. Michael Hoffman was the first one to teach me this concept, and that is the notion of sacrifice, as it gets more and more intense over time, comes into existence in proportion to the increasing demands made upon the natural order, which often refer to the countryside. Nature will only give so much. Civilization increases that in demands and demands and demands, and so mechanisms have to be developed to force an unnaturally large amount from natural sources, forcing nature to give far more than it normally would. In order for that to happen, sacrifice is necessary. Death somehow is connected with excess. Sacrificing children is just one element of that. Another element would be the automobile. As I mentioned this before, you know, how many deaths does automobile cause every year? The amount of money that it takes to maintain roads, the taxes and tolls and everything else, the upkeep in cars, the psychological toll that driving takes on people. All of that would be a sacrifice granted because the human mind isn't made for that kind of speed. A natural form of transportation, of course, would be a horse or the river or something like that. When you increase it, double it, triple it, you then have to sacrifice something. You sacrifice in terms of death, you sacrifice in terms of psychological pain, constant expense, and everything else. You can think of a million examples of how this could be the very grid necessary that civilization demands is more than the natural order would ever give. It is an unnatural concept. The very fact of, you know, the Solomon's temple that Peter the Great, for example, thought was, he was imposing on nature in northern Russia to create Petersburg. Solomon's temple is not the transfiguration of nature that you have in a Christian idea, but the replacement of nature, being able to improve on it to such an extent that it becomes a purely human notion. Spengler's idea, and this was done long before it really became well known. He was one of the first, actually. You have 19th century writers doing this too. 19th and early 20th century writers doing this. You know, you have the idea that civilization is what you get when elites demand more for the natural order than it would normally give. As cities grow in wealth and power, the countryside is violated more and more. Not just our increasing number of people taken from it, but to be able to feed these huge cities requires the regimentation of peasant life to the point where it just becomes one big mechanism in and of itself, like you have today in with agribusiness. The family farm isn't just about producing food, it's about producing people. It's a cooperation with nature and a knowledge of nature. As I've said before, Russian intellectuals, even liberal ones in the 19th century, began to discover that the Russian peasant was in fact brilliant. They would come back from studying him saying he could talk to animals. He knows so much about how things grow and develop that it's almost as if there's no real border between the peasant and that which he works on, the soil and the growth, and that the concept of talking to animals was extremely common. They know each other so well that where one ends and the other begins is almost impossible to discern. People coming from the city, seeing this for the first time, are overwhelmed with wonder. They have no idea what they're looking at. They live a life so artificial and so based on training and intelligence rather than actual wisdom and instinct. Talking about Oswald Spengler, again, I'm only talking about this one aspect of him because it's centered of really the great contribution that he's given. He's many others, and we'll talk about that some other time. But the notion of the decay of culture, nation, family, essentially we've all one and the same thing, extended family, of course, into civilization. And when that remains unchecked, the pressure that it places on everything else is intolerable and overwhelming. And we talk about GMOs and the destruction of the family farm and the replacement of the person by the ego, the community by the collective, two very different things. This is what we're talking about. And it's essential. You want to make one first step into breaking free from the liberal postmodern ideology. That's your first step. Understanding the difference between civilization and culture. The difference between the organic and the inorganic relative to social forms. Anyway, thank you for listening, everyone. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.